This is number 0077, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0077. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actress Marissa Ramirez, who is one of the stars of the television series Spartacus: Gods of the Arena. She did her first nude scene in that show. Was that a difficult experience?
It was difficult for me. I just wanted to make sure that I was going to walk away from it and still be proud of what I did and make sure that it was tasteful and none of it was, you know, trashy or tacky. And so I'm pretty sure that I think I held to my guns and I made that happen. I had to just stay with what I was comfortable with, but it was still very difficult.
Former teacher Gabby Chapman is the author of Let Them Have Books. She wants to get kids to read, and she wants them to read voluntarily. Is that something that's hard to do?
It is a problem by sixth grade. I had taught third grade earlier, and they were very enthusiastic about reading. But by sixth grade, quite a few have lost their enthusiasm. So, yes, I had to encourage them to enjoy reading, but it was actually very easy to do.
Meryl Weinsaft Cooper is one of the co-authors of Be Your Own Best Publicist. What's one of the major keys in getting your work noticed?
Good work is the best way to get noticed. But also, not just patting yourself on the back, but patting others. So supporting your coworkers or colleagues and highlighting what they do, then people would be more likely to point to the good work that you've done. It's just doing for others will help you do for yourself.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0077, was Paula Samuel, a reporter and anchor at Global News here in Montreal. And yes, that's the same place where I also work. Thank you very much, Paula, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Okie dokie. Now, while it's been over 40 years since his shocking killing spree, Charles Manson continues to be one of America's most notorious serial killers. And he's still making news even from behind bars. Mr. Helter Skelter was caught for a second time with a smuggled cell phone in his cell at Corcoran State Prison. Now, Manson was issued a rules violation the first time for possession of a contraband cell phone, which cost him 30 days credit for time served. Like that's really going to make a difference to Charles Manson. He allegedly used it to make calls and send text messages around the world. Now he's been caught with a cell phone for a second time. He has been denied parole several times so far, as you may know, and this probably won't look good at his next parole hearing, which comes up next year. Anyway, Manson is 76 years old. Now, what baffles me is that he even knows how to send a text message. This is a guy who shouldn't have any knowledge of technology beyond the time of his incarceration. He should just sit in the cell in his bell bottoms with his lava lamp listening to his 8-track player. That's just the way I feel. That's all I'm saying. Okay? Meanwhile, moving on to Silver Springs, Maryland, police in Maryland arrested a man after finding his cell phone charging at the scene of a burglary. Now, Montgomery County police say 25-year-old Cody Wilkins has been charged in other burglaries. It began when a homeowner's son arrived as a burglar was going through rooms in the home. Startled, the burglar jumped out of a window and fled. The son called police, who searched the home and found a cell phone charging in an electric socket. The phone led police to Wilkins. Police say Wilkins' home was among those in the area that lost power last week when a snowstorm moved in. Arrest records say he's been linked to other break-ins. Wilkins was brought to a Montgomery County jail on $1 million bond. Well, where he's going, he won't have to worry about charging phones or power failures, although he will have to deal with lights out. This guy almost made, by the way, the idiot of the day, but he's not. That comes later. As a matter of fact, he was even nominated by listener Thomas J. Airy for Idiot of the Day. And thanks, Thomas, for thinking of the show. And keep listening. Moving right along to Westbury, New York we go. This is a new low. A mail carrier in New York's Long Island area has been accused of pinching thousands of discount coupons intended for residences' mailboxes. Police say 38-year-old Thomas Tang of Baldwin stole more than 7,000 JCPenney Company discount coupons that he was supposed to deliver to the department store's customers. Police say Tang then sold the coupons on eBay. Tang was charged with grand larceny. I don't know. Have you ever given thought to some of the things that show up late in your mailbox? Never mind missing, just late. For instance, you ever get magazines that show up weeks late? Just wondering. Anyway, while America may have repealed the infamous don't ask, don't tell policy of the military, our Turkish friends haven't advanced quite as much. In Turkey, the military's homophobia is legendary, as they incorporate both zero tolerance for homosexuality by service personnel and the requirement of rigorous proof by anyone applying for exemption from service by claiming to be gay. In Turkey, homosexuality is the only disqualifier for compulsory service for able-bodied men, but if you're going to claim that exemption, you'll be ordered to verify your claims. Some men claiming the gay exemption were recently ordered to either produce witnesses to their homosexual acts or show photographs of themselves fully engaged in the receiving position during sexual intercourse. So not the giving position, it has to be the receiving position. Anyway, so now you know what that means. The Turkish military probably has a very unusual collection of gay porn. And apparently, the Catholic Church in Italy now wants to control women's thoughts. A Roman Catholic tribunal in Modena, Italy, recently ruled that a marriage can and should be annulled on the grounds of the wife's adultery, even if she only thought about having an affair. Wow. What if she had thoughts of having an affair with someone in the Turkish military? Also, what about the thoughts of Catholic priests? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Israeli researchers writing in the journal Fertility and Sterility found that women undergoing in vitro fertilization were almost twice as likely to conceive if they had been made to laugh by a hospital clown entertaining them as soon as their embryos were implanted. That's just creepy. You know, there are people out there who are terrified of clowns, right? This would make an interesting sequel to Rosemary's Baby, don't you think? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Joining us right now on the program is one of the stars of Spartacus, Gods of the Arena, the six-part prequel to Blood and Sand. Actress Marissa Ramirez plays a body slave to Lucy Lawless's Lucretia. Hi, Marissa. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So this is quite a departure from some of the stuff you've done before. First of all, you've flown around the world to do this part. I believe you shot it in New Zealand. Is that correct?
We did, yeah. We're pretty much in the future, 17 hours ahead in New Zealand, and it was quite a trip to get there. But it's an amazing country with amazing cultures and great people. So it makes the experience that much better just to be somewhere else and do something completely different.
It is completely different. I mentioned the title, Spartacus, Gods of the Arena. This could easily have been called Flesh and Blood because there's a lot of both.
Yeah, it's pretty gory.
Right from the opening scenes of the first episode, tell me, how did the part come to you in the first place?
It was pretty late in the casting process. I think they'd been sort of searching around, and my management hadn't really presented it to me, and then they did, and, it was one of those things like, well, there's nudity. You always said you wouldn't do nudity, and it's in New Zealand, and I don't know. So I went in, and I met with casting director, and then I met with Stephen DeKnight, creator, and, you know, it's just one of those things where you kind of have to step out of the box and do something different every now and then just to sort of shake it up and sort of show a different side of me. And it wasn't easy. It was very difficult for me to go there. It was such a challenge. But I think in the end, it all looks great, and I'm happy with it. And I can say that I'm proud of what I did.
Well, let's go back, because you mentioned the fact that you said in the past you wouldn't do nudity. You did in this particular show. And I should mention right off the top, very tasteful stuff. So we should mention that. Was it a difficult hurdle for you to go through or to climb over?
Definitely. It definitely was. You know, I'm one of those people, and, you know, everybody is like this. I'm so hard on myself. I'm so hard on my body. I work out, you know, sometimes 2-3 times a day, and I'm still never happy, and I probably never will be happy. So it was just really tough to be there on set in the wintertime in a, you know, pretty much wearing nothing. And you know, the producers and the crew were used to it because they had already worked on season one. So it was like nothing for them to see some boobs around. But it was difficult for me. And I just wanted to make sure that I was going to walk away from it and still be proud of what I did and make sure that it was tasteful. And none of it was, you know, trashy or tacky. And so I am pretty sure that I think I held to my guns and I made that happen. And I had to just stay with what I was comfortable with. But it was still very difficult.
Had you, I take it you'd seen Blood and Sand.
I hadn't seen it until I got the job. And then they sent me the first season. And so I did a quick sort of watching all of them, and I became familiar with the show, and it's one of those things where it's just something so different being able to do a period piece and being able to have this sort of mid-Atlantic accent and show a lot of skin was just something that I felt like I had to take this sort of next step, and so I did. And I really enjoyed the first season. There was a lot of blood. It was something totally, completely different than anything that I normally watch. But people love it. So, and my husband loved it. He told me to go to New Zealand and do the job. So if he's okay with it, I'm okay with it. We just have to make sure my dad's okay with it. And so far he has been. So,
tell us about the character you play.
I play Melita, who is Lucretia's body slave, which just means that I'm basically her personal assistant. I'm always there following her, pouring her wine for her, entertaining her guests, taking her jewelry and putting it away for her, just that sort of thing. But Melita has been in the house for a very long time, so she sort of has a closer bond with Lucretia than the other slaves do. And Melita also has a husband who is an Emmaus, played by Peter Mensa. And my character had been gifted to him in the past. He must have done something pretty good to earn a wife. And so it made Melita just a little bit different than the rest of the slaves, because I have this relationship and this love. And you know, working as a slave, there's always death around the corner. You never know what could happen. You could do something wrong and you could be fired, killed, who knows. So knowing that I sort of had a husband there and you can go to the husband and have love there, it just makes her that much of a more sort of a wholesome slave, I guess.
Now, the thing about our society, we live in what we like to think is a relatively liberal society. Having said that, you are in a period piece, and it tries to depict a certain reality as to what that period was like. Do you think we live in less liberal times than the time depicted in the show you're in?
Yeah, I think back then there was no judgment, and anything goes, and nobody is frowning if there are two male gladiators going at it in the corner. You know, it's just accepted. It's just the way that it is. Everybody's having sex with everybody. Everybody's naked. Everybody, you know, there's just, it's different. There's no stereotyping. There's no judgment. There is a certain class system, which, you know, it's just the way it was back then. But,
How was it working with the crews and the cast in New Zealand?
The crews were amazing. I completely bonded with my makeup artist and just, you know, the Maori tribe people, the Maori culture is just so amazing to me, and they're so powerful, and just being around it, it inspired me to, you know, sort of give the best work that I could. And the crew is just very sensitive and very sweet to me, and just, they're just good people, you know, and it's nice to sort of step away from LA and go somewhere where everybody's just genuine and sweet, and they're just trying to create the best possible product. And working with the cast, Lucy is amazing. She is the sweetest, humble, genuine actress I'd ever met. You know, she's the kind of actress who, during break time, would go to her trailer, break up a bunch of chocolate bars, put them on a big platter, and walk around and pass out chocolate to the crew and to the extras and the cast. And she's just a sweetheart. And being around her, working around her, was just pretty amazing.
Well, being around Lucy Lawless, she knows a thing or two about period pieces. Any tips for someone like yourself who was working on something, you know, quite different from what you've done in the past?
She was just very focused on sort of trying to show that we had a different relationship than she has with the other slaves. Like, Melita and Lucretia are almost friends in a way, where she bosses the other slaves around, you know? And that was pretty much what her focus was with me. But watching her act and watching her deliver her lines with her accent and everything, it helped me, you know, it helped me go there.
This is one of those types of shows. It's shown on Stars in the United States, here in Canada on the Movie Network and Movie Central. It's one of those shows that has an international appeal. Do you anticipate a boost in your career, a boost in recognition, because you're in a show that has such a broad appeal, not just in the United States?
I don't anticipate anything. You know, I just work. And whatever comes of it, comes of it. If nothing comes of it, I worked, you know. I don't necessarily look towards the future and hope that a job will get me more jobs. I'm just the kind of person that just wants to work steadily, whatever I'm doing. You know, it would be great to sort of work internationally and you know, maybe go to, I don't know, Paris and shoot a movie there or something. But I don't really look for that. I just look for work.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. As I mentioned, it's a 6-part prequel, so it's only 6 parts. Is there the opportunity, the chance that it might continue?
Well, they're slated to do season 2, but you know, season 2 came after season 1, and the prequel is sort of before those 2. So Melita wasn't around in season 2, but you never know what could happen. I wouldn't turn down the opportunity to go back to New Zealand to shoot an episode or two, but contractually I'm not obligated. So, but we'll see.
What's up next for you?
I just shot a pilot in Toronto for the Lifetime Network. It's called Against the Wall, and I'm sort of in waiting mode, waiting to hear if it's going to get picked up or not. I was supposed to know today, but I was supposed to know last week too. But in that, I play an internal affairs detective who is 6 months pregnant and very hormonal. So that was completely different from me going from New Zealand wearing almost nothing, then going up to Toronto and wearing a big preggers belly and pretty much eating as much as I could because I hadn't been for 3 months in New Zealand. So
we had you on the program in the past. We mentioned some of the work you've done in soaps on General Hospital, The Young and the Restless, other things you've done. Now you've done Blood and Sand and the pilot you're in. All very different. Are you must be very happy and gratified that you haven't really been typecast, unlike a lot of people in the past.
Yeah, there still is a hint of that for me. And you know, sometimes there's nothing you can really do to get away from it, and you just have to sort of deal with it, because, you know, a lot of times, because of my last name, I go in for only Latin parts, and I don't speak fluent Spanish, and that has sort of hindered me in the past, but I just keep going and keep trying not to get pigeonholed. But, you know, some people are just very close-minded, but I have been very, very lucky in the past just to keep working and be able to, you know, pay my rent, pay off my car. I'm very lucky. So
Well, a lot of luck comes from the talent itself, and you are very talented, and continued success with what you do, and good luck with Blood and Sand, and Spartacus, Gods of the Arena, and maybe there will be more of your character in future episodes. I thank you very, very much, Marissa, for taking the time to talk with us.
Anytime. Thank you so much. It's good to hear your voice again.
Actress Marissa Ramirez, one of the stars of Spartacus, Gods of the Arena. It airs in the U.S. on Stars. Here in Canada, you can find it on the Movie Network and also Movie Central. And as the saying goes, check your local listings.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about getting kids to read voluntarily and liking it. Also, we'll give you tips on how to be your own best publicist. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day. That's all coming up. But right now, more Stuff File news for you. And we start off with a story from Warsaw. A Polish hunter who dreamed of shooting an elephant has sued a German-based travel company after it sent him to a part of Africa where he said there were no elephants to be found. The company, which organizes hunting expeditions, insists there were elephants in the area of Zimbabwe that it sent the hunter, identified only as Vladimir I. From what I know, the hunter should have seen elephant excrement there. That's a quote from the company owner. Even though the company organized a second trip for the luckless hunter during which he did manage to kill a male elephant, the man still filed for damages worth $130,000 over his first expedition. Gee, I wonder if Bob DiRigo Jones has seen this one for his Let's Be Fair segments. And by the way, I'm going on the assumption that while looking for elephants, since they're kind of large, they would be hard to miss. I'm also guessing that for that very same reason, so would their excrement be hard to miss. Anyway, on to Albuquerque for our next story. Albuquerque police said a supermarket worker accused of handing out a yogurt sample contaminated with semen was arrested on outstanding bench warrants. The Albuquerque Police Department said officers were called to the Sunflower Market by a woman who said the store employee by the name of Anthony Garcia, age 31, gave her a free yogurt sample contaminated with bodily fluid. The woman told police she spit the sample out because it tasted like sperm. Police said they are running tests on the sample. We found where she basically spit out the possible evidence, said Sergeant Trish Hoffman. As far back as I can remember, this is the first time that we've ever dealt with this. Investigators said Garcia was arrested on two outstanding bench warrants, one of which was for failure to appear for an arraignment on two counts of criminal sexual contact with a minor. Okay, I know what you're all thinking out there. I can just imagine. You know, people often say certain things taste like chicken. That's because we all know what chicken tastes like. Now this woman, Moving right along, police in Gilbert, Arizona are trying to find a man suspected of four bank robberies in the area. No weapon or getaway car have been spotted, but the suspect was said to have stated during one of the robberies, "Give me all your 20s, 40s, and 60s," which has earned him the name $60 Bill Bandit. Officials consider him armed and dangerous. And careless, because apparently he left all the 80s behind, but I digress. Moving right along, talk about ruthless revenge. A UK immigration officer who was angry at his wife decided to get even by placing her name on a terrorist watch list so she couldn't get home from Pakistan. The officer used his access to security databases and added her name to the list of people banned from flights into the UK while she was visiting family overseas. Now, the woman, who had no idea that her husband had done this, went to the airport only to be told that she couldn't get on a flight. Adding to her frustration was the fact that the officials didn't offer an explanation. Now, when she called her husband to ask his help with the matter, he promised to look into it, but left her stuck in Pakistan. For 3 years! Yeah, ironically, this all came to light after the officer was being vetted because he had applied for a promotion that required a higher level of security clearance. Now, when his superiors realized his wife was on a watch list and questioned him about it, he broke down and confessed. Instead of a promotion, he was fired for gross misconduct. I'm going out on a limb here, but I'm thinking this relationship is over. Meanwhile, in Orlando, Florida, former Ku Klux Klan Cyclops George Hickson, who is now 73, and his 45-year-old son, Troy, got into a fight with Troy's girlfriend, which resulted in Troy allegedly firing gunshots towards the woman's feet. This resulted in a subsequent arrest of the two men. So what was all the fighting about? Well, according to county deputies, the altercation was precipitated by the girlfriend's unhappiness that she got the cheap beer while the men got to keep the good beer, which is Budweiser, for themselves. You know, sometimes a stereotype, such as, oh, I don't know, rednecks, is deeply rooted in historical fact. That's all I'm saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's your pro tip of the day. If you're going to rob a bank, you might want to avoid running right past police headquarters. Orlando police said they caught suspected bank robber Jonathan L. Graves shortly after his heist of the SunTrust Bank branch. An officer inside the Orlando PD headquarters looked out his window and spotted Graves hiding from a patrol car and watched as he then took off running. The officer relayed the info to other officers who caught up with Graves and arrested him less than an hour after the robbery. Know your flight plan. Know your escape route. That's all I'm saying. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? How do you make sure kids will learn to love how to read without doing any arm twisting? Well, on the line with us right now is Gabby Chapman, who is the author of Let Them Have Books, A Formula for Universal Reading Proficiency. Hi, Gabby.
Hi.
Now, are you currently a teacher or are you a former teacher?
I have retired last year.
Okay. So what ages were you teaching?
I was teaching 6th through 12th, and it was a small school, so I got to have the same kids year after year.
Generally speaking, did you find that there was a need to try to get kids to want to read as opposed to forcing them to read? Is that a problematic situation?
It is a problem by 6th grade. I had taught 3rd grade earlier, and they were very enthusiastic about reading. But by 6th grade, quite a few have lost their enthusiasm. So, yes, I had to encourage them to enjoy reading, but it was actually very easy to do.
Well, first of all, why do you think they lost their enthusiasm somewhere along that line?
Number one reason is they were made to read books they didn't want to read. And the number two reason was that the act of reading was used as a torture instrument, kind of, to teach them how to read. An example is the round robin, where everybody in the classroom reads a paragraph and you wait and then you read a paragraph, and some struggle with reading, and it's sort of meant to teach fluency, but it's basically teaches them to dislike it. Those are just one example.
It's funny you mention that, because I have to admit, I mean, I spend my entire life as a public speaker, and I have no problem with it. But going back to school, I tend to remember not necessarily enjoying that. You know, that round robin you were talking about. So I can see how that can be problematic.
Yes. And so the best thing, of course, is to give them books that they're interested in reading. But there's very little of that done in schools.
Okay. Well, I wanted to go back to that first point you mentioned, and that is there are things they don't like to read. So you're in school. There are some things in school, let's be honest, you have to do. So is there a way of getting around the situation of getting kids to enjoy a little more some of the reading material that they have to read? I mean, not everything can be what they want to read.
When they're young, when they're in learning how to read, they need to learn how to enjoy reading. They shouldn't have to read anything until they get into really high school. The reason that they have to read things is because we educators often think that that's how to teach them to read the best way, when it really isn't. If they read, and I have many, many examples, if they have lots of access to books they love, by fifth and sixth grade, they can be reading at high school level, just from reading books that they enjoy and reading lots of them. So we spend a lot of our time in school, instead of letting them read the things they enjoy reading, trying to make them read stuff we think they should read and do exercises on it and answer questions on it and write papers on it. And they get very little out of it that way. Plus, they get a real distaste for reading.
Okay, well, you've taught for many years. Obviously, you've seen this problem firsthand, and you seem to have at least some of the answers as to how to correct the situation. Were you a teacher who would fight against your own curriculum?
I was fortunate enough to work in a charter school, so I got to make my own curriculum. So I didn't have to fight against anything. And every year, my students did very well on all the tests, so nobody complained.
Okay, so what was different in what you were doing than what most of us grew up with?
I spent a lot of my time figuring out what interested my kids and what books they would like to read. And I gave them time in class to read. I never assigned a book that they had to read. Spent a lot of the teaching time on things, discussing things about reading, like plot or characters that they all enjoyed talking about. I also spent a lot of time on teaching writing and things that they could use to more appreciate the books they were reading. And really, that is the biggest difference, is that I let them read the books they chose instead of making them read books I chose.
So let's flash forward to this book, which you now have, Let Them Have Books. Who exactly are you targeting with this book? Are you targeting educators or parents or both?
Both. And the reason I am both is because both are involved in teaching kids how to read. It can't be one or the other. And one of the things I also emphasize in my book, besides encouraging kids to read their own books, is the importance of early literacy, what happens before they even go to school, and the importance of understanding how kids learn to read differently. And those two things can give a kid a really bad idea about reading before they even start to learn to read. So it's really important that parents are involved in that. And educators, because a lot of educators support this kind of teaching, this approach to teaching, and understand that a lot of their children have, their students have a hard time reading and are looking for ways to improve that. So it really takes both.
So what's the first thing or the most important thing parents should try to do to encourage their children to read? And does it differ at different ages?
Well, you know, the most important thing, first thing, is they need to read themselves, because, and they need to read for the joy of it. They cannot, a parent or a teacher cannot show a child how to love to read if they don't love to read themselves. So that's the first thing that I recommend. For parents in particular, reading to children when they're small, but also talking to them a lot about everything, because the more words a child knows before they start to read, the easier it will be for them to read.
Looking at today's technology, things like e-readers, the Kindle, the list goes on and on and on, does that make it a little easier, do you think?
I'm not sure if it makes it easier. It's still so new. My students still loved books, but I can see the real value of the e-books and the Kindle books. Being able to carry around a whole lot of books in a much smaller space, for instance, and I think that it may be easier in the long run. It's just too new right now to tell.
Do you find that sometimes the way we teach children to read can turn them off for life? In other words, is the damage done and there's no point of return if we don't do it correctly when they're early, or when they're young, rather?
Well, you know, there is the point of return, and I found with my students, almost all of them, no matter how much they hated it when they came into my class, could change their minds. But there were a few, you know, like maybe two or three over the course of 7 years, that hated it, not only hated it, but had such a bad experience learning how to read that they were just so traumatized that they could hardly even look at a line of words. And that was unnecessary. That was something that had happened in their early years that had caused that. So that's why I think it's so important to address the early years.
And going back to some of the things, like you mentioned, the round robin and other and reading lists and deadlines, is part of the problem that we kind of make it, without really intentionally doing this, we kind of made it competitive? That you must be able to read this in a certain pace, you must be able to finish this book in a certain time, and that people tend to read at their own pace?
Oh, people do tend to read at their own pace, and they certainly have their own interests. And as I said, kids learn to read in different ways, but still, there's no reason that I can see that all children by third grade should be able to read at level and should be able to enjoy it. It doesn't need to be competitive. I can't see any reason why it should be competitive, particularly if kids are allowed to read their own choices.
And how much effort should parents be putting into this? And by that I mean, there was a train of thought that you know, you just send your child off to school, be it kindergarten or whatever, and they should know their ABCs by then, but usually they start reading when they're in school. Should you try and teach your child to read as early as possible, and what is too early?
No, I don't think you should. I think that, for instance, we know that there's certain developments of the brain that need to take place before kids can undertake the process of learning to read. But they can certainly learn oral language well in their early years, and they can learn that from being read to, which parents should do every day, and talked to a lot also. From the very earliest, people think, well, the baby can't understand what I'm saying, so why should I talk to them? But that's how they learn. The more you talk to your children about everything, the better they will be prepared to learn to read. And, of course, there are things you can do, getting them familiar with letters, understanding the alphabet and sounds. And I have lots of things on my website that for parents in that case. To do, but in terms of actually trying to teach them early as a way to make it an advantage, it doesn't really work that way.
And we should mention that website is letthemhavebooks.com. The book is called Let Them Have Books, and it's written by Gabby Chapman. And Gabby, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Gabby Chapman, author of Let Them Have Books, A Formula for Universal Reading Proficiency. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then go to the episode number for this show, which is show number 0077, and you'll find links to Gabby's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones. Last week, a major news hub published a column I wrote about a lawsuit filed by a U.S. congressman. The lawsuit was so stunning, I thought the American people deserved to hear about it. The congressman decided to sue a cafeteria over a vegetarian sandwich he bought. According to the lawmaker, he bit into an olive pit in the sandwich and hurt his tooth. His lawsuit demanded a jaw-dropping $150,000. Sadly, it's just one lawsuit among millions filed each year. Now, I don't know the extent of the damage to his tooth. The congressman refused to reveal how much his dental work cost. I objected because he chose to sue in the first place, forcing the cafeteria to hire expensive lawyers to defend themselves over a sandwich. The day after my column, the congressman decided to settle the matter out of court. Let's be fair, I'm not taking credit for the outcome, but I believe it was the public outcry that eventually led the congressman to decide there are better ways of resolving disputes over sandwiches than with a lawsuit. Learn more. Go to my website at bobdorigojones.com.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will give you a tip or two on how to be your own best publicist. And we do indeed have, as we normally do, an idiot of the day coming your way. But I have one more Stuff File news story for you before we get to our next guest. 39-year-old Stacy Champion has been charged with animal cruelty after she actually tried to mail a 4-month-old puppy from Minneapolis to Atlanta. The postal worker was stunned, I say, when the package moved by itself and fell onto the floor. Then came the sounds of heavy panting. Champion paid $22 to send the black poodle schnauzer mix puppy named Guess to Georgia via priority mail. On the outside of the package, she wrote, "This is for your 11th birthday. It's what you wanted." The dog is now at the city's animal control facility. And while the crazy Miss Champion isn't commenting to reporters, she did find the time to return to the post office and demand, I say, a $22 refund for the mail she paid for the puppy. She also wanted a small amount of money that she had attached to a makeshift dog collar returned to her. Postal workers nixed the refund and told her to contact law enforcement about the collar currency. Gee, if she thought she could mail a puppy, does it concern you at all to just what this wingnut might have tried to and perhaps successfully sent through the mail in the past? I know it concerns me a tad. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? In this tough economic market, how do you get yourself known for the work you do and are capable of doing? Well, on the line with us right now is Merrill Weinsaft Cooper, who is the co-author of Be Your Own Best Publicist, How to Use PR Techniques to Get Noticed, Hired, and Rewarded at Work. Hi, Merrill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So,
thanks for having me.
Be your own publicist, that's not like be your own doctor or be your own lawyer. Sometimes you could be your own worst client.
Indeed. And actually, people have a really hard time being their own best publicist in the workplace. They feel like it's too much bragging, or especially women have a hard time touting what their accomplishments are. They feel a little shy or awkward. So Jessica Kleinman and I wrote this book, Be Your Own Best Publicist, because it's really simple to leverage those classic PR techniques to get ahead in the workplace. Just like celebrities have teams of PR people managing their reputation, it's more important than ever to be managing your reputation, how you're seen, how you come across, whether it's online or offline.
Now, you just brought up an interesting point, the fine line between promoting yourself and bragging. How do you even know where that line is supposed to be?
Sure, exactly. We like to say to your own horn, but not too loudly. I mean, first and foremost, it's about showing your value. So it's about doing a good job, making sure that all your T's are crossed and I's are dotted, which is what you'd want to do. Good work is the best way to get noticed. But also not just patting yourself on the back, but patting others. So supporting your coworkers or colleagues and highlighting what they do, then people would be more likely to point back to the good work that you've done. It's just doing for others will help you do for yourself.
Now, as I said in the intro, these are tough economic times. Are the tools that you're espousing in your book, is this a situation that we should have all been paying attention to in the past, even in the better economic times, or are these tools just geared because of the situation we're in these days?
Certainly, there's never been a better time, but these tools have been used to great effect, not just by the celebrities, but by great coworkers. You may know the person who is just known throughout the company for doing a great job or always raises his or her hand, and that's just not in this economic time. It's any time, but now it's more important than ever because people are being asked to do more with less, and also, you know, with companies looking to cut costs in any way they can, you want to be the person that shows value, stands out, and is seen as indispensable.
Well, removing the bragging aspect of it, what about a personality who's just uncomfortable touting their own horn?
Exactly. Well, I think that there are lots of ways to do it. Another way to do it that we talk about is making sure that as you do a good job and people tell you you could do a good job, to collect that evidence. So ask people to put it in writing. So you have that on a sheet when you're going in to ask your boss for a raise or for a promotion, or if you're someone who owns a business and is looking for a new client, then you can actually take that information in. It's similar to I represent a lot of hotels and restaurants, and when we get a good review, of course, we pull the best quotes, we put it on the website, we put it on a sheet, and make sure that people know that these are good things. That's a great way to toot your own horn, by using other people's words.
Okay, let's talk about PR from the point of view of what a lot of people are going through these days, and that is, be it with downsizing or early retirement, people are branching out and doing their own business. And in this case, here is a situation where perhaps they've worked a lifetime doing something, working in a business or in a company, and have never had to thought of doing their own PR.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think first and foremost, you want to know what you want to accomplish. So let's say you're branching out on your own. You want to start with a plan, right? In PR, whenever we start a new project or a new client, we sit down, we think, what are our goals are, and then we work backwards from there. So if it is about starting a business, you want to figure out what you want to accomplish and then how to get there. So maybe some of the steps are, I'm going to register the website, or I'm going to reach out to all my friends and let them know I'm in business so that they can start to talk up your business. Then you want to have your messages down. So what makes you different from other businesses that are around? So have three key messages about how you can describe yourself in 30 seconds or less, like an elevator pitch. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with that concept. Consider your audience. Who are you going to be reaching out to? When we're pitching for press, we would never use the same message for a New York Times reporter as we would with a Cosmo reporter, right? So you understand what's going to resonate with your people and then go forward from there. And then we like to say your network is your net worth. It is all about who you know nowadays, and it's about staying in touch, not just when you need something, but throughout the year, so that when you do need something, it doesn't smack as insincere.
What about the role of new media in this day and age, social networking?
Oh, wow. You know, we say everything's on the record, and anything you say and post can and be used against you. And I don't know if you saw the New York Times article just maybe a week or so ago. Your digital profile actually outlasts you. So it could be your lasting legacy even when you're well beyond this when you've shucked off this mortal coil, if you will. So it's important to be considering what every single bit that you put out there. We like to say hit the pause button, so that, because if you recall, I mean, before the age of internet, it was really easy. You would write down a note. If you were angry, you would write down a note. You would put it in a drawer. You would take a moment to think about what it said and not just shoot it off because it could have landed wrong. So nowadays, though, with gratification being so instant, people think nothing of firing off a missive, an email, just because they thought of it. And that can be quite detrimental for our careers as well as for friendships. So we recommend hitting the pause button, taking a second before you hit send.
Which brings us to also a very important part of PR, damage control.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, sometimes in life things go awry, so it's important to stay calm and carry on and make sure that you're keeping perspective. In PR, we have a saying, it's PR, not the OR. There's always a way around it. There's always a solution. There's always a workaround. And when you have a plan, like I said, you should always have a backup plan, plan B, C, or D, to make sure that you're keeping moving in the right direction. I did an event in Vegas with a team, and we were going for it was the MTV Music Awards, and we were trying to get to a suite, and we were blocked off, and we had to get there in 10 minutes, and the cab could not get to where it needed to go. So we found a shortcut. We hopped a fence and went there. And we like to say, don't be afraid to hop the fence. You know, there's always a way, a shorter way to get there. Not a shortcut, but just looking for solutions that make sense.
Okay. Now, earlier you talked about the fact that when somebody is perhaps starting a business, they have to look at what their business plan is and really analyze the whole situation. It's almost like doing therapy on your business plan before you go out there with PR.
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't know where you want to go, how will you get there? So it's about being super clear, being true to yourself. You know, people get caught up in the shoulds, and it's a matter of being honest, because today, authenticity is so key. Knowing yourself, knowing what makes you special. We talk a little bit about having a signature, whether that's a signature appearance, signature style. Some people wear a lot of vintage or have a really cool pair of glasses. Some people wear bow ties, whatever. But it could also be a signature such as sending a handwritten note or a quirky little bauble that you send as a forward. So it's good to understand what makes you stand out and play that up. And so really being clear about how you're presenting yourself in all ways.
You and Jessica wrote the book, Be Your Own Best Publicist. Both of you have been publicists for quite some time. What brought you to the point where you felt this book needed to be written?
Well, you know, especially in this tough economic time, we did feel like it was the perfect opportunity. And in this moment where image is absolutely key and your digital footprint is set in cement, there wasn't a better time to write it and to leverage our 30-plus years of combined PR experience.
The book is called Be Your Own Best Publicist. And I thank you very, very much, Meryl, for taking the time to be on the program with us. Now, there is a website that goes along with your book as well, and that is BeYourOwnBestPublicist.com, correct?
Absolutely.
And I also understand that you are out there on the social network as well?
We are. We're on Facebook, and we're under Be Your Own Best Publicist, and we're on Twitter at Best Publicist.
Meryl, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Meryl Weinsaft Cooper, co-author of Be Your Own Best Publicist, How to Use PR Techniques to Get Noticed, Hired, and Rewarded at Work. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then go to the episode number for this show, which is show number 0077, and you'll find links to Meryl's website and also to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
This is the Stuff File.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
An official in Portland, Oregon says a house fire that caused $30,000 in damage was apparently started by tenants who were using a hole in the floor as an ashtray. Portland Fire and Rescue spokesperson Paul Cora says, in his words, "That's not careless smoking, that's stupid smoking." He says the caller who reported the fire also hung up on the 911 dispatcher, then refused to talk when the dispatcher tried to call back for more details. No one was injured in the fire. Now, why would someone use a hole in the floor as an ashtray? Come on. There's only one reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0077. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the site, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0077. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me as PH Holder on both Facebook and Twitter. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.